This is Innovations in Patient Care. Hi, and welcome back to another episode of Innovations in Patient Care. I'm your host, Jamie Davis. This episode is sponsored through the generous support of Physio-Control. Find out more about how they are helping healthcare professionals innovate and improve outcomes in healthcare at physio-control.com or look for them on Facebook and Twitter. This week on the show, I have a special interview with Dr. Ed Rocht, recorded at EMS World Expo this past year in New Orleans. Check it out. This week, we have a special interview with Dr. Ed Rocht. Ed is the Chief Medical Officer of American Medical Response and has served the EMS community with his knowledge and leadership for over 20 years. So here's my most recent chat with Ed at the EMS World Expo in the Physio-Control podcast studio. Check it out. Hi, Jamie Davis here for the MedicCast. We're here at EMS World Expo 2016. In the Physio Control podcast studio. We're really excited to be down here again, talking with all of our friends and guests and people that are in the know. And because we couldn't find any of them, we...
If there are any questions at all, please feel free to write in. Thanks for your time.
Bye-bye. No, in all seriousness, Dr. Ed Rocht is here. And Ed, it's always a pleasure to have you on the show.
Always nice to be here.
And we're going to talk about a kind of serious topic here because it's something that we're running into quite a bit. Before we get into that, why don't you just refresh everybody's memory, tell everybody what you're doing and who you are.
So, Ed Rocht, I'm the Chief Medical Officer for American Medical Response. I've been in the organization for about 6 years. Was the Medical Director for City of Austin, Travis County EMS for about 13 years. Got my start in Richmond, Virginia with the Henrico Volunteer Rescue Squad and Richmond Ambulance Authority and the Richmond Fire Department, and had some wonderful times across the board.
Excellent.
Learned a lot.
And so we're going to talk about active shooter and EMS finding themselves in suddenly hot zones. And we've talked about this, my colleague Sam Bradley at the Disaster Podcast, we've talked quite a bit about active shooter incidents, the need to be prepared for them to occur, because they're occurring more and more frequently. And it's not just this once in a lifetime, maybe you'll hear about it, maybe you'll actually run into it in your service. They're happening so frequently that they're happening in rural areas and suburban areas and urban areas. We just can't get away from them. So what kind of things are you guys thinking about when you start looking at active shooter response?
So, you know, you pointed out, and I think it's important that we all put in perspective, I think everyone involved in EMS, when the first few active shooter events occurred, we said, you know, boy, I'm glad that's not happening in my neck of the woods. That's an isolated event. That's something that, you know, we've got great law enforcement, we've got great surveillance, and you know what, knock on wood, that won't happen here. And unfortunately, what we've seen over the past literally 18 months has been a pretty significant increase in active shooter hostile events, but also a diversity in those events, which is one of those subtleties that's almost as concerning. So whether it's a nightclub at 2 a.m, whether it's a daytime takeover of a Planned Parenthood environment, whether it's a mall, whether it's crowded, whether it's not, internationally, whether it's motor vehicles, it's all changed. But the focus is the same, and that is an individual or a group of individuals that want to cause harm, and they want to do it in a way that they feel is going to be most effective. So how do we prepare ourselves and how do we respond in that kind of environment? So EMS has a skill set. We've been able to, I think, nicely manage gunshot wounds. We've been able to nicely manage isolated events, but the tides turn. So there's larger numbers of patients. There are, unfortunately, many of these events now are targeting public safety, targeting the uniform. So it's changed our world, much like emerging infectious disease changed our world. It's like, well, wait a minute, Ebola, I can spell it, I can Google it, but what is it and what does it mean to me? So we had to rapidly evolve our practices and change and become smarter, wiser, so that we could take care of our communities. So we have, at AMR, we've been involved in just about every major shooting event in the past year or so, with the exception of Baton Rouge and a few others. So we've had a lot of opportunity to work with our law enforcement colleagues, to work with our colleagues across the country who have expertise, our military colleagues, to learn from the literature, and to look at what best practices are, and to try and assemble a sense of where we're going and how we're going to address things. And I think, you know, one of the things that's been important for us is, what are the questions? So it sounds really stupid, but are the questions, is it a matter of transitioning our deployment in a community? Do we develop a tactical medicine program in conjunction with law enforcement, if that's part of what's going on? Do we change our staging? Do we change personal protective equipment? Is our education and training focused on appropriate hemorrhage control? Do we know how to manage IED, the implications of explosions? Is our triage system appropriate to this kind of an event? So really framing the questions has been, I think, an important part of our evolution in trying to make heads or tails.
And you're absolutely right. I mean, our existing triage systems are really set up for that train accident, that bus crash, that,
right.
You know, that the incident is now over.
Right.
Now we can manage the injured. Where if you have an ongoing active shooter incident, I'm thinking of Orlando, for instance, you know, how many hours was he actively available to come out of that bathroom?
Yep.
If you were going to go in and clear people out of the nightclub,
right.
He could come out that door any time.
Right, exactly.
And so you have a completely different setup there. And where do you stage in that situation?
Right.
And you're not going to be in a situation where you're two blocks away from a trauma center.
Right, that's exactly right. And, you know, so we've had a lot of discussion with our colleagues over the clinical care of patients. So a lot of international dialogue on where does the medical care provider, where do they intervene in events like this? So in our world, in the world of EMS, there's warm, cold, and hot zone levels of care provision. So historically, traditionally, if you're providing medical care in the hot zone, you are part of a tactical team, you train with that team, you have competencies associated with that team, you have personal protection, you have protocols and approaches that are so well defined that that team functions as a specialty team to go into a very high risk, very dynamic environment. The warm zone, it's been kind of limbo, right?
Mm-hmm.
The warm zone is like that transition between cold, theoretically safe, and hot, theoretically very high risk. Warm has kind of been, does medicine go in and provide some care and extract? Does medicine stay out? Who functions in that zone and what's the appropriate level of functioning?
Right.
So we've had, and I think nationally, there's been a lot of discussion about that warm zone care. And this is my own personal opinion, offer not available in store, void where prohibited by law, objects in mirror are
right.
Closer than they appear. But if you look at the injuries that these patients have, so these are destructive injuries, these are hemorrhage, this is trauma. If these individuals are badly injured, they need an operating room, they need to be fixed and repaired in a green tiled room, we need to get them there. There are very few of that patient population that have significant airway issues, that have significant, other than, of course, obviously, head and neck involvement. These are hemorrhage control. These are stopping the bleeding and getting that patient as quickly as we can to the right level of care. So it worries me a little that we're talking about advanced levels of care that go further into danger, as opposed to getting those patients out of the higher risk area of care, taking care of them and getting them rapidly taken to definitive care, to the operating room or to a trauma center or appropriate level of care. So I think a lot of what we need to talk about is how do we engage the general public? How do we engage the community to be ready for this? How do we work with our law enforcement colleagues who are protected, who are
right.
competent, who are trained, who are familiar to say, you know what, if you got to get them out of there and literally just drag them out of that hot zone and get them to a place that we can safely move them on and take care of them, how can we help you with that? As opposed to thinking about laryngoscopes and drugs and pain medication that's going that way. A very, very small subset of patients need that.
And we talked earlier in this very studio today about the discussion on, is ALS on the way out? Because what you're talking about is the fact that there's there's BLS interventions you're talking about here.
Huge topic.
And then transport.
Correct.
And like you said, very few airway-involved situations where they need advanced airway, you know, absent the facial neck trauma.
Right.
That would
or
be involved.
Alternatives or alternatives to manage that airway that
don't require that
advanced license.
And the other discussion that I've heard in other places is, you know, do we train the law enforcement with the rapid application of a tourniquet?
Absolutely.
And then bring them out.
Absolutely.
You know, and so like you said, they have the necessary training to be in the hot zone. We can train them to recognize an arterial bleed.
Right.
And the application of a tourniquet, rapid application of a tourniquet.
Right.
While they're being covered by their fellows.
Exactly.
And then get that person out.
Yeah. So it's interesting. I was yesterday in the airport here in New Orleans. There were two critical care nurses out of Seattle, and we got talking about, you know, medicine. It's one of those things, you know, nurses and doctors and paramedics, they have this ear. It's like, I think there's a like professional somewhere near me. So we were talking about the changing times, and, you know, these two individuals are in Seattle, and we were talking about cardiac arrest survival rate and how that community, everyone in that community, the students, the parents, the professionals, everyone is so ingrained in the resuscitation side. They're so entrenched in compressionally CPR. They understand the importance of 911. They know and they know how to use AEDs. So we were looking around the airport, and I said, you know, if you look around the airport, maybe 85% of the people in this airport would know how to do CPR, probably, I'm guessing. Maybe 60% would be familiar with an AED, probably 5% would know how to appropriately place a tourniquet. So if you look at that, the message to us as EMS providers is that's our new public education target. It's hemorrhage control, how to apply a tourniquet, how to stop the bleed, wonderful campaign, how to stop that bleed, so that first level of care can start managing that patient as responders are heading in.
And let's not even talk about bystanders. There are EMS providers out there who really aren't taught how to stop major hemorrhaging.
Right.
They're taught apply pressure.
Right.
They aren't taught you get your fingers and that gauze and you go into the wound.
Yep.
And you press as hard as you can.
Yep.
They aren't taught that.
Yep.
They just, you just lay your hand across the top and put a little pressure on
Big ABD. Yeah. Lay it over there, let it absorb.
Yeah.
Right. No, I think you're right, Jamie. So
we're not even teaching ourselves how to do it correctly.
Right.
And the same thing with tourniquet. You know, we're taught tourniquets once or twice, and then it goes the way of the mass trousers and everything else that we've learned to apply one time never again. Yeah. Or
what?
The KED or the...
What's that?
Yeah, exactly.
Mass trousers. How old are you?
I'm dating
just
myself
kidding.
Here,
yeah.
Right? But it is... You know, it was a skill we had to learn,
right?
And we don't use it,
right?
And of course, it's been since disproven and gone away. But tourniquets are an essential tool now. We know that. We've seen it. You know, we know from these events, looking back at them, that massive blood loss is the cause of death in many situations. So you're right.
A very treatable cause of death.
Yes.
A very preventable cause of death. And you know, I think you're right. Many, many years ago, there was a nurse who taught us about managing wounds. And one of the things I will never forget she talked about is, and this was not in the injured patient, but she said, look, if the patient doesn't complain that you're pushing too hard and that hurts too much, you're probably not controlling what you need to control.
Right.
So cardiac cath, I mean, you're pushing on a groin to keep the vessel from rebleeding. It's not comfortable. It's got to stop that hemorrhage and stop that bleeding. And you're right, it's a shift in our focus. It is a very targeted approach to say you have to be very thoughtful, very specific, very firm, and you got to make sure you're doing what you set out to do.
So how's AMR tackling this, essentially an education issue?
So we made a decision about a month and a half ago that we would establish a an ASHI task force. So our active shooter hostile event task force, a mix of operational and clinical leadership, physicians inside and outside of AMR. Dr. Rich Carmona, former Surgeon General, has been gracious enough to work with us on Stop the Bleed and some of the principles associated with managing that patient population, both operationally as well as from a clinical standpoint. We started an ongoing messaging, so we believe that small bits of information on a regular basis are probably going to be retained better than a big bolus of information at one time. Mm-hmm. As we did with Ebola, we've set up a web resource for our folks or whoever, where the literature is available, where plans and best practices are available, so folks can go and really kind of explore what the science says is important. And then we started to work on some consensus documents. So one of the things that we've had a lot of discussion on is, as you described, suddenly hot. So we describe, you know, if I go into a building and I'm going to the fifth floor to take care of someone I think has chest pain, and I get there and, you know, somebody comes out of the elevator with a gun, I'm suddenly hot. I didn't expect it. It's the ambush scenarios, unfortunately, with our colleagues in the fire service. So I'm suddenly hot. What do I do if I'm suddenly hot? So I revert to essentially a civilian mode that says, my partner and I, you know what? It's out. It's a run, hide, fight. I am out of that environment and I get to safety as quickly as I can. So trying to anticipate those scenarios, trying to make sure we are smart in what we do and not change staging strategies unless it's really a thoughtful approach. Because the other component of that pendulum is the public doesn't want EMS staging for potentially highly significant events if there's really not a reasonable risk. But at the same time, we shouldn't be going into scenarios where there is a reasonable risk that it's unsafe. So trying to manage the balance of those two.
Yeah, and I look at the, you know, things like the Aurora, Colorado shooting, movie theater shooting, where the police were evacuating people and were probably responsible for saving numbers of lives because they took the initiative rather than waiting for ambulances to be brought in. And I think the lessons are there to be learned. Like you said, a thoughtful approach towards changing your staging protocol.
Right.
And if not just changing it because somebody else, you heard somebody else is changing it.
Absolutely.
Do what you're doing with a thoughtful approach.
So our colleagues, you know this, our colleagues in Pennsylvania are studying that exact issue. So the penetrating trauma patient that is either placed in a law enforcement vehicle, police car, and taken to the trauma center or transported by ambulance. So a controlled approach to looking at which of those methodologies is best. And there's been some criticism from the lay side of the house saying, how could you not send an ambulance? When I think all of us in medicine realize that what the patient needs is to get into the operating room.
It's transportation.
The fastest way that we can safely get them to the operating room is probably what's in their best interest. So hats off to our colleagues for studying that, for looking at it in a very thoughtful, evidence-based way.
And that'll be interesting to see the results of that when the time comes. It really will be. Ed, we could keep talking all day, and we'll probably talk again, hopefully. So I want to thank you for coming
on the
show.
Always a pleasure. All right.
If people want to look and find some of the resources that you mentioned here on the show that AMR makes available, where can they find them?
If you go to AMR.net and then go to OEM, Office of Emergency Management, you'll see that there is an active shooter hostile event web resource there.
Excellent. Well, we'll make sure that we have a link for that in the show notes for this episode.
That's going to wrap up this segment and episode of Innovations in Patient Care. Stay tuned for more segments from the top healthcare, EMS, and nursing conferences this year as we continue to focus on ways that healthcare professionals, just like you, are providing innovative care and improving patient outcomes all the time. Thanks again to Physiocontrol for sponsoring this and other episodes of Innovations in Patient Care. Make sure you say thank you to them on Facebook or Twitter for helping me bring you some of the best in healthcare innovators every year. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. You can check out my other shows in the iTunes directory or over at mediccast.com. I'll be back soon with more from Innovations in Patient Care. In the meantime, stay safe and stay tuned here to Innovations in Patient Care.